welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome to the top of the new episode, and welcome back to It's an Inside Job. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Well, today I am very privileged and pleased to be able to introduce you to an interesting guy, Patrick Berglund. Now, he's the CEO and co-founder of Zenata. Now, Zenata is a trailblazing company in the industries of logistics and supply chain management. Now, we're not going to explore Zenata so much. I'll let Patrick speak to that. But in today's conversation, we're going to dive deeper than the surface level success of Zenata. We're exploring the very essence of entrepreneurship through Patrick's journey. From the highs and the lows of building a company from the ground up to facing the unpredictable tides of the business world, Patrick shares his invaluable insights. We'll discuss overcoming adversity, navigating through uncertainty, managing conflict, and the relentless pursuit of motivation and inspiration. You know, Patrick's story is not just about the success of a company, it's about the relentless spirit of entrepreneur or being an entrepreneur. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur yourself, a seasoned business leader, or simply intrigued by the mindset it takes to turn vision into reality, I think this conversation promises to be very enlightening, inspiring, and intriguing for you all. And so without further ado, let's slip into the stream and meet Patrick Berglund, CEO and co-founder of Zenata.
Thank you, Jason. It's an honor to be here.
I was wondering if we could maybe kick off the conversation by you introducing who you are and what you're about and what you do.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Patrick Berglund, and I'm a founder of Zenata. I'm also father of two girls. Just want to put that in. So it's more than just business in life. But my background is from transportation and logistics, supply chain. And 11 years ago, I started a company called Zenata. And the basic principle of Zenata is it's built to solve a couple of problems in shipping primarily, right? So air freight and ocean freight is what we're targeting. And these are industries that collectively move more than 70% of global trade. Most people don't relate too much to these industries, but it's incredibly important for global economy. I describe it as the main artery of global economy because they move so much of everything we consume, right? And the basic problem in the industry is that it's an incredibly volatile market. So prices changes all the time, right? And then it's opaque. So if you imagine you being one of the big brands in the world, whether it's Amazon or IKEA or Adidas or any of these companies, Pfizer, pharma companies, automotive, whichever one, you need to ship your product around. The challenge you're facing is that you never know what the going rate is in the market. And the reason for that is that all prices are individually negotiated. So you will have one company negotiating with a shipping line or a freight forwarder to reach an agreement for a price between, let's say, Shanghai to Hamburg or Los Angeles. And what that causes is that not only do you have volatility in the market, but you have a huge spread because everybody's achieving something different in their individual negotiations. So what we decided with Zenata is that if you can imagine almost a room with 500 or so big Fortune 1000 customers type of businesses, if you imagine them sitting in the same room and you ask them one question, what do you all pay today between Shanghai to Los Angeles? And they would all share, they would be all informed as to whether their price is good or bad in the current market, right? So what I find interesting is that we chose a crowdsourcing principle in a business-to-business world where we managed to get proprietary data at scale enough that you fill the room with enough participants so that you statistically can say, as per today, this is the average, this is the high, this is the low. And then they get to see themselves within that market. And that's the core value of what Zenetta offers, right? Now, we have then built a market intelligence platform that sort of takes on the buy side. But we always knew that if we could get enough buy side to go into negotiations leveraging our market data, then that would shift information asymmetry between the buyers and sellers in favor of the buyers, which indirectly would force the sell side to also join in order to balance that information asymmetry, right? And for the past 5 years, we brought on board a majority of the big shipping lines globally. We have 8 of the top 10 global freight forwarding companies leveraging our platform, all headquarter level. We've never gone for like local branch offices or anything like that, because we knew that if we're truly going to get a foothold in this industry, we need the core key decision makers to embrace it. And that's been sort of the journey. Now, if you pause that for a bit, I would like to add one more thing, because we said that there's a problem that they're buying and selling somewhere between $300 and $800 billion a year of ocean and air freight, and there's no visibility on it. Now, if you think about those individual negotiations, they are very inefficient. There isn't like no central clearinghouse that will tell all participants in the market, here's where the market is, and you can strike a price very efficiently. So we said, if we can get our hands on that data, get buyers and sellers on board, then eventually we can change how they buy and sell, because there is no reason for them to do that manual, cumbersome process to figure out where the market is when we can tell them with the simple click of a button, right? So as per now, we have built a platform that allows buyers and sellers to more seamlessly agree to which price they should ship their products at on all the different trade routes around the world. And then on top of that, we've bolted on additional complementary data sets, which would be reliability, capacity, emission data, right? And my ultimate goal with this company is to enable the buyers to be fully informed 24/7, to sit down with any carrier in the world and say, if you're going to move from Valparaiso to Jebel Ali with this shipping line versus this shipping line, here's the pollution you're going to have, here's the price points you can achieve, here's the reliability you're buying. And that is unprecedented in this industry. There is no company that can provide any equivalent visibility and transparency that Zenetta does today. And yeah, that's a bit of a long-winded introduction to what we built.
No, but I mean, when you're talking about such a complicated industry, I think it's good to give it time and breath to speak to the details. As you said, most of us just, you know, we order something, you know, as a private citizen, and it ends up in our mailbox, regardless if it's coming from China or the States or Brazil or wherever it's coming from. And we don't see the veins and the arteries that puts this global machinery together. And so that's why I think it's so fascinating to be able to have a conversation with you today, Patrick, because I'd like to explore two things. Obviously, it's the foundation and the road to build Zenetta, but it's also sort of the entrepreneurial mindset, the sort of the challenges and the adversities and the triumphs that you and the company have made small or big, that I'd like to explore today to understand how you created, or how your team, how your company created together a very resilient presence on this marketplace. Because I'm sure you didn't make a lot of friends putting all this together along the way, and that you had your trials and your tribulations. I'm just a little side to it. I was just wondering, Zenetta, where'd you come up with that name? And does it mean something specific? Is it a combination of words or what have you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I always wish and dreamed I had a really compelling story behind the name. Okay. but you know, when we kicked it off and we called it the crateindex.com to begin with, and we realized that there was...
That sounds sexy.
Yeah. There was a much bigger demand for this than we sort of anticipated. So we realized we needed like a brand name. And then we wanted a .com domain that was short. And if you start looking for that in this modern day and age, it's everything is taken, right? Mm. So at some point, we just stumbled across Xerox, if you're familiar with the copy machines and the brand. And they, I thought about it, they pulled off two X's in a name. And for some reason, I found it somewhat powerful. Mm-hmm. So we started searching for .com domains with X to begin with, because it was more availability. And that's
that the boring story. Yeah.
Yeah,
elephone.com.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's interesting. I just it was more of a curiosity. It's just a little side note I was just curious about. I was wondering, maybe you could speak a little to, you know, you've had the insight, you've built the company, and you've kind of you've been climbing this hill to where you guys are. How was it as an entrepreneur? Maybe could you rewind and tell us a little about your story as an entrepreneur? And obviously you saw the insights, but maybe some of the trials and the tribulations, some of the adversity you found along the road.
Yeah, I mean, I usually share internally that it's been like a long journey of doing things you had no idea about how it should be done. I'm a first-time entrepreneur on a VC-backed journey. I've done one company before, which was like brick by brick, right? So it's very, very different. And we had 4 years of zero revenue, right? Because if you go back to that analogy of people sitting in the room and sharing their prices to be more informed, you actually start off with zero companies in that room. So the first one you go to, you just tell them, hey, I want to build this thing. All it requires is for you and X amount of other companies that ships on the same trade route with the same container box, same contract duration, to join me in this room and share proprietary data. So it's such a chicken and egg problem in the beginning, which means that you reach out, you might find somebody who's like an early adapter and understands the problem you're trying to solve and wants to buy in and help you. So they give the data. Obviously, you can't charge because you have no other matching data to stack it up against. So there is zero value for a good period of time. And for years and years, we kept on fundraising with zero proof points that this data would eventually be valuable, right? That's a pretty tough pitch to make to investors. And then we kept on losing data because say you convince Electrolux or Nestle or whichever big brand you can imagine that this will be a good outcome for them eventually. So they join you for a year, maybe, or half a year, but you don't find other companies that are willing. So by the time you get to the 1 year period or 6 month period, their data expires. The prices they paid and negotiated with the shipping lines are now outdated, and they saw no value in giving it to you. So they don't want to give it again, right? Because it's, again, confidential, sensitive data. And those four, I would say, years to begin with, they were just grueling. And I remember, you know, plenty of conversations with my co-founder where we would leave the office, go to like a cafe or somewhere to sit in a park and just like bitch and complain, to be honest. Like, this is never going to work. Because we were like bringing in stuff and bleeding it on the other end when it comes to data. And then you needed that data because that fits the narrative towards investors as to, hey, look at the data is growing. More and more companies are willing to give this data. At some point, we're going to turn the key and charge a subscription, right? Mm. So in parallel with that, it required an enormous amount of grit and persistency and conviction that ultimately, when it comes together, it will work and it will yield substantial value, right? Now, my experience from being on sort of the buy and sell side of the industry, from that, I knew how I theoretically would leverage this data if I could get my hand on it. That's why I could have a pretty compelling story to the to the big brands, right? Because I could explain to them, if I get enough of this, I would use it to set your budgets. I would use it to assess the risk in your supply chains. And I would use it as leverage when I negotiate the right deals. Mm. And if they buy from, let's say, $10 million a year to $1 billion a year, then that, if you can optimize that with 10, 20, 30, 40%, depending on the market condition, it's a huge amount of money, right? And in parallel, as I was saying, these 4 or 5 years when we were building it up in the beginning, this supply side hated our guts. Because if you think about it, if you're selling anything to anyone and they have no idea what the going price is, you have such an advantage. So the idea of the market becoming transparent, easy to navigate for their customers, was not something they were pleased about. So we've had some of the biggest shipping lines in the world threatening with lawsuits. We've had the forwarders the same, the freight forwarding companies. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing, which I understood pretty early on, is that we could tell the shipping lines and the freight forwarders that if you don't want us to have this data, you got to go to your biggest and most important clients globally, and you got to tell them that they can't put the pricing contracts into Zenera. Now, when you do that, you're also telling them that you're ripping them off, but you just don't want them to see it.
That's all. Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah.
So we managed to sort of play around these core stakeholders and convince them, ultimately, as per today, to more or less all join. And I've always said internally, they all will join. This makes no sense to stand on the outside. You're losing out so much. And the opportunity to create efficiencies, do more data-driven decisions for companies of this stature, just is connected and associated with so much money and win. So yeah, as per today, it's coming together very nicely. It's very sticky. We're not bleeding out the ones who comes in anymore. And we built an entirely different product and offering. But it's been a long journey of disappointments, I guess. Mm. And I always thought about it as one no is closer to a yes at some point, right? And you just got to keep on grinding it and then refine the approach that you're taking and learn from the no's to increase the amount of yeses that you're getting for every no.
Yeah, because I think that's what I want to get into. I want to get to the DNA of your thinking, because I can understand the first 12, 24 months, you're hit with adversity, you're hit with challenges, but you're thinking that's the short term, you keep going. But then you hit the third year, then you hit the fourth year. But obviously, you've got maybe small successes along the way. I'd like to return to that park bench where you and your business partner are venting and you're whinging and you're complaining about the difficulties, which is completely normal mindset. And as you said, you were driven by a compelling story to tell to the clients, to your customers, and that kept you going. I was wondering, you know, when we get into a negative mindset, we can tell ourselves stories that can actually tank us, that can actually sink us and derail us. What was the compelling story you told yourself? I know you said for every no, there's a possibility to get closer to the yes. I was wondering if we could elaborate and explore more what you and your business partner did to try to get back on the horse, because maybe it wasn't so positive, but you needed to have the shift into some sort of constructive mindset. Could you walk us through that?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think there's a few things that sort of drives me on, and I can even see this coming to play when we've had periods of stagnation. So I think I have a huge curiosity and hunger for learnings, right? So irrespective of the sort of timeline component here, what I've cared mostly about is what does it give me in terms of development and learnings. And I told my chairman this several times as well, that it's the most expensive education I could possibly dream of, right? We raised 130 or so million US dollars. Right, to build this company, and I've had the privilege of going through seven funding rounds with venture capital firms, hedge fund, private equity. It's I've traveled the world. I met executives from the biggest companies in the world. It's like I couldn't dream of that. So, if my motivation was primarily the financial reward, I think I would struggle for periods of time when the company's not performed well. Right. So every time it's been a bit more tough, which is, it's been very cyclical, right? Two, three good years, one bad year. Then again, two, three good years, one bad year. And it's like getting through those rough periods, I would say the first 4 years and then the cyclicality after that, and staying composed, it's helped a lot for me to focus on, okay, but what did I learn? What did I develop? And then, like an example today, we have our annual kickoff. It's digital this time in January, and then in person next week. But today it's digital, and one of the things I'm going to focus on is what have we achieved over the past six-ish years. Mm-hmm. And when you do take a step back and you look at what we've accomplished, then that fuels me a lot as well. Like, we started doing our what we call the Zenera Customer Summit 7 years ago, I think. And I started looking back at photos. That the first one was like an audience of 40 people, right? And now, last year, we had more than 500 people flying into Amsterdam from the biggest companies in the world, from the US, from all continents, into Amsterdam, where we hosted this, where we had the CEO of Hapag-Lloyd doing a keynote, which is the fourth biggest shipping line in the world. We're talking about the ones who hated our guts, who's now accepting our invitation, showing up in person, on stage, with their name behind it, the sort of biggest influencers in this industry. And it's mesmerizing to me to see that position. Like now with the Suez Canal situation.
Yeah.
We're in Reuters, Bloomberg, CNBC, BBC, Financial Times, just for the past 2 weeks, every day in mainstream media. My chief analyst is directly transferred on Arabic TV as he shows up in the newsroom. It's that sort of like position within our, what I would call a gigantic niche, that makes me convinced that we're moving in the right direction. So I try to sort of look past these sort of shorter term hurdles and mistakes, because we make mistakes all the time. All I care about is not making the same mistakes again, right? So what did we learn from it? How quickly did we react? And what did we change, right? And going from 22 to 23, we had a great example where we spent like 6 months readjusting our messaging and way of selling, because through COVID, the market skyrocketed 800-900% up in terms of prices for a container box from Shanghai to Hamburg. Insane budget increases for our customers. Now, as that dropped off from 22 to 23, we didn't adjust how we sold and went to market. It took us months and quarters, and we lost out a massive opportunity. Now with the Red Sea, we've adjusted in 2 weeks. And on Wednesday yesterday, I told my team, this is exactly what I care about. I don't care that we spent 2-3 quarters and what it cost us. That was a huge mistake. But now we're showing that we learned from it. Next thing I want to see is us adjusting in days, right? And that's the way I try to focus and not be sort of worn down and bogged down about the mistakes and challenges that we're constantly sort of finding ourselves trying to solve.
Yeah, because what I like about what you're telling me is very pragmatic, because back on that park bench, back in that cafe, when things weren't going as well, now with hindsight, you see the red thread and all the right choices and the wrong choices and how you adapted to those wrong choices to make better decisions along the way. But back in, well, whatever, those 4 or 5 years you guys were struggling, you had no crystal ball. As you said at the top of this conversation, everything was uncertain. Everything was a new step. We didn't, you know, it was completely an unmapped territory. And so what I heard was, it was not so much maybe a compelling story you told yourself, but a compelling question to help you focus. And as you said, it's like, it's such an expensive education. It's given me such deep learning and insights into how to grow things. And you could never learn this in a university. And I really like the way you created a compelling question, because in a sense, when I used to word, it's reframing. What you've done is reframed, because a lot of the times you couldn't change the situation per se, but what you and your business partner did was, you know, after the venting and the whinging, which is allowed, then you got up back on the horse and you decided, okay, how do we reframe this? And what I hear is that you couldn't change the situation, but you changed the perception or how you perceive that situation. And by changing that perception, that changes your emotions. from disengaging to more engaging, as you said, grit, right? And then obviously that leads to action. And there's only two actions, as we said, engaging, disengaging. And this compelled you forward. Now, I really like that because what I also heard you say, you know, especially with this, the sort of the Zenata summit you have and where you have the traditional way of looking back, but in this case, it'll be all over the last 6 years. I think that's also very good to celebrate the wins, but understanding those wins did not come easily. It took effort and investment and mindset to do this. Because I think that is so important because a lot of us, a lot of the times, are constantly looking forward, which is healthy. But looking forward, that's like an unpainted canvas. Those are things that have yet to come to fruition. But what I also hear what you and your organization do, Patrick, is that you look over your shoulder and you see the road that you've walked, that hard, tumultuous road, but nobody can take that away from you because those are facts. Those are things that are etched in stone. And sometimes that, when we're facing a tough future that we can't see our way forward, just to know that we've walked that hard road and that we've learned and we've gained insights can create, as for you, a compelling question, or maybe it's a compelling narrative to move us forward. I just wanted to encapsulate that because I think that's the nuts and bolts of what I like to get in this podcast, is talking to men and women of your caliber and to understand the DNA of their mindset and how they come through adversity.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think it's a difference of sort of being stuck in the past and looking back to see whether you actually achieved something. Even if you failed, even if last year was like a long string of failures, you'll most likely, that's very rare to happen, right? Mm-hmm. If you do enough stuff, if you work hard enough, you'll find some things that you actually achieved and did well. But I think it's worthwhile thinking about two things. Mm-hmm. All the stuff that went well, but all the stuff that you tried. Because my hypothesis is that I'm not alone thinking this way, but if you can try as many things as possible, as fast as possible, then the odds of succeeding increases, right? But if I put all my bets on like one thing for 2024 and we don't succeed and that's it, then I'm at huge risk. So breaking it down into like 100 things we're going to do as an organization, but all tied to our sort of bigger vision and longer term aspirations, then that allows us to quickly churn through a lot of failures before you hit something that works. Mm. And most processes is like this. Now, obviously, one caveat that I want to mention is that with time and with growth and size of the business, we've also been able to attract completely different people, right? Mm. Not that the ones we didn't attract in the beginning was great, but now we can find people who's done the journey before, from a tiny company to $1 billion valuation plus, right? We can attract people who comes from the biggest tech organizations, whether it's Google, Facebook, Amazon, and so forth, right? Mm. And what I found is that as the company matures, more and more weight can be taken off my shoulders, right? Whereas in the early days, it's way more scrappy. You don't have any resources. You're always constrained and you've got to compromise and fill the gaps yourself, which means that you surround yourselves with, let's say, a lot of talent who hasn't seen and done it before. So the journey is very, very different at this stage than it was in the beginning. And the requirements from me or any of the ones who's been with us from the early days. And just to be clear, we have like 5 people out of the 240 working with us that was with us in the first 1-2 years. Yeah. So you also churn through a lot of people and relationships. And I'm a pretty relationship-driven person. So it's been one of the hardest things that I've gone through, realizing that you got to part ways with people you've been shoulder-to-shoulder working mm-hmm. you know, around the clock to make things happen, achieve great things. But what used to work is not necessarily what's going to take you forward. So there's very few individuals who can do that transition from let's say 3, 5, 10, 20 people to 250 people. And I would assume from the learnings I have so far that that's going to continue, which means that you're also going to, in some way, burn yourself a little bit on a lot of relationships because you care. I care about people. So it's very hard to sit down and say, this is the end of the journey for you. And obviously you don't do that from overnight, right? It's a process and you got to try and make it work. But it's got to be driven by the individuals, that level of development, because it's the same for me. Every year I sit down with our chairman and I assess whether I think I'm the right one for the coming 12 months to run this business, right? And when I look at this, I look at these are probably the areas where I have gaps, right? Mm. And then it's a matter of how do you bridge them? How do I figure out how it's going to look like when we're 350 people, 500 people? What are the initiatives I need to start now? And what is the team I have around me in order for us to reach that? So that means that I'm constantly, or once a year, evaluating my own position, but I'm constantly looking at the org and especially my leadership team, whether it's the right one to take us where we need to go and what kind of gaps do I have? And my approach to that is either finding entrepreneurs who's further ahead in the journey, so double the size, triple the size, so that you can sit down and chat with them about this stage. Because what is very clear is that there is a lot of things that is sort of common denominator, is the same way of building that works for a lot of SaaS businesses. So you don't need to reinvent the wheel. And by speaking to them, investors who's involved, and hiring more people who's done the journey before, then you have an opportunity to understand what is your own sort of self-development that you need to ensure happens in order to remain relevant. And this is why so many people fall off, because they start off doing a job and they continue doing that job. And at some point, the company don't need that job anymore to be done in the same way as before.
In the first part of our conversation, Patrick shares his journey through the early challenges of founding Zenetta, emphasizing a period of 4 years without revenue. He underlines the necessity of grit, persistence, and the conviction that their vision would ultimately succeed, despite initial resistance, especially from the supply side, which benefit from opaque pricing. You know, Patrick's motivation was fueled by a hunger for learning, seeing every challenge as an opportunity for growth, and likening the journey to the most valuable education he could imagine. He navigated this path by consistently asking three critical questions. What did we learn from our mistakes? How quickly did we react? And what did we change? You know, this reflective approach helped him and his team to learn to adapt and stay focused on progress, viewing every setback as a step forward. We all face trials and tribulations in our private and professional lives. The question is, can we take on board maybe these three questions that Patrick asked himself and his team? And this will allow us to be more reflective, resilient, and robust moving forward through our own challenges. So now let's slip back into the stream with part two with my fascinating conversation with Patrick Berglund. I mean, how do you get outside your own head? How do you sort through your own thoughts? Because as you said, you're a father of two daughters. Obviously, you're running a huge business, a very complicated, with a lot of moving parts kind of business. You know, you've got your health, you've got your social life and such. But how do you sort through your own emotions and sort through your own head with such a complicated, I'm assuming a complicated life with a lot of moving parts?
Yeah, it's a great question. So
not that I'm trying to push my services on you.
different periods of times, I've done different things, just to be clear.
Yeah.
Right? If I focus on the last 6 months, I found a new coach, psychiatrist that I regularly speak with. I've had different sort of sparring partners for different stages and different also in some way, but quite often I can find myself meeting somebody who's very interesting and very relevant for a period of time. And I think I've been good at sort of exchanging them, switching them out so that I have something, and no ill intentions, right? But at some point you sort of extracted a lot and the additional gain is more nominal than in the beginning. But the coach has been phenomenal, or a psychiatrist. And we worked on simple things like defining your dream sort of every day. Like, how does it look like? Because with the amount of work, I must admit, I've worked a lot more than what is, I would say, a normal working life, right? And how do you still reserve some time to spend with family, but also being mentally with them when you're with them? Yeah, and it's been a huge challenge. It's taken me many, many years. I'm not there yet, even. Right? I still have a lot to improve, but I've done anything from pragmatic stuff like, I have a smartphone at home in the weekend, Saturday. I put up like a dumb phone. I have like one of those old Nokias and I put it away. Otherwise, I'm constantly on, right? So do those kind of like strict boundaries as to like how you behave and treat your spare time relative to work time. Then for many, many years, I always just worked a little bit harder to get stuff done. Now my mantra is a little bit less. Not because I don't want to work a lot, but the switching of the mantra to a little bit less forces me to prioritize a little bit harder, right? And then I've never, since we started, never gotten through my to-do list. So what my chairman told me early on is like, you'll never get through it. Your main responsibility is to constantly sort it so that on the top of the list, you have the most critical stuff and the rest will burn. And you will need to live with everything that's constantly burning and the disappointment of that, right? Because you simply cannot get through it. And then one final thing, is another sort of analogy I like to think about is I always sort of thought about Zenet as a vessel with so many holes in it. And you are, as a founder who's so deeply involved, you're aware of all the holes. And when you step back and look at it, you can either panic or you can decide which ones are the biggest holes, who's taking in the most water, which if I plug them, will move faster. And then I go back, take a new look at it and assess the holes again. So, yeah, it's a bit of a stretched answer, but...
it's very specific because what I hear is a man who... He's not searching for balance because I think balance is just a complete misnomer. It doesn't capture what we're trying to do in complex lives. And I think an entrepreneur such as yourself and some of the entrepreneurs that listen to this, I think it's about integration. And it's as you said, creating boundaries and understanding that, you know, today, this Tuesday, I have to work 12 hours on the business. But tomorrow, I spend time with my girls, seeing them in gymnastics or soccer, and I'm fully present with a Nokia flip phone, a dumb phone, as you said. And it's finding this integration and then being okay, coming to peace with that. And that sounds as you said, you're part of your mantra, maybe part of your personal philosophy. And I guess you've had to learn this. As you said, you're not fully there. You're an iterative process. And as you go along, you learn and you gain insights, just like you have with building the business. It's also about understanding how to integrate your private and professional spheres of your life in a way. Is this what I understand you're saying?
Yeah, I would actually add one more thing that I've learned is that I've become much more critical as to what gives and what steals energy. Because I figured out it's not the amount of hours, it's what I do, what I'm involved in. And this is also one of the things I discussed with my coach recently. It's like, how do you optimize your time so that you're as energized as you can? Because ultimately, that's beneficial for Zenetta. And that means that for everything else, I should do as little as I possibly can and distribute that and give that away to others. And this is a little bit what I meant about finding the right team around you so you can take off the weights from your shoulder. Because that has allowed me to do things I'm also good at. Right? So that sort of creates a cycle where you get more energized, you feel more fulfilled because you're doing stuff that you're mastering and obviously stuff that I think is very important for the business as well. it's almost like when I described my calendar a while back, it was like I complained about it. And we agreed that the goal is going to be to have a calendar that you're excited about and look forward to. And that means that if you prioritize correctly and with the mantra of doing a little less, then you got to be even more strict of what you put in there. And I think that's been tremendously helpful for me. And it's very like a pragmatic thing to do. Just pull up your calendar, relook at it. What is it that I should do? And I've been very clear to my team for the past, especially 6 months. These are the things I'm not good at. These are the things I've hired you for. These are the things I've hired you for. You'll carry that. You make all the decisions. Don't bother me with it. If you need somebody to spar with, I'll chat with you. Otherwise, I'm going to go and focus on these things.
What is very interesting is when you gave the analogy of, you know, Zenata being a boat, and a boat has some holes, and you know, it's a patch-up job. And in a sense, there's an English word called triage. It's like, you know, when soldiers get injured and the sort of the doctors have to deal with it, sometimes they have to look at the most serious wounds first and treat those, while the smaller ones just have to wait, or they're able to survive for a time. And so that's what I hear you doing. You need to be actually self-aware. You need to be able to articulate, okay, what are the biggest holes and why do I need to deal with that? And then you said, then I have to, or your chairman suggested, you have to be at peace with that. Some things are just going to have to burn or fill up a little bit with water. And I think that comes back down to a very eloquent word in English called equanimity. It's understanding that you are not able to deal with everything, that you need to find some sort of collectedness or calmness in the uncertainty. You know, there are going to be fires that burn, but they will burn at maybe a slower rate, and you have to put out this fire first. And I just want to say that, because that in itself, it sounds quite, oh yeah, that's easy to do, but it isn't. That takes some mental gymnastics, and it takes experience to learn this. It's not something you can pick up from a textbook. That's something you've talked to your psychiatrist or your corporate coach with, to understand these things. And it sounds like this has evolved as part of your learning insight into your own personal philosophy.
Yeah. And when you do put one thing to add to the mix, actually, that please, I think is also worthwhile, is when you do put family on top, you end up being stretched even worse, right? So this is one of the conversations I've had with my wife, who's been phenomenal through this journey as well, that I really like to do things sort of wholeheartedly. I know that I can like put in 100% of what's required in order to do something. That's like the self-belief, right?
Sure.
And then whether I'm great at it or not can be discussed. But when I got family, I realized that there isn't enough hours in the day where they are awake and I'm awake. And like, so she told me, like, you'll do 80% of what you would dream of doing on both arenas, right? That means that you'll never be fully satisfied with what you're doing with Zenata, and never fully satisfied with your role as a dad, unless you change this, right? Unless you decide to retire and go 100% here. And that conundrum has been very, very hard to accept. But I think, because obviously if I can cut off family and just do Zenata with like no other focus, I would do even better, arguably, right? You can debate whether it would be mentally sound in the long run, but accepting that there's like, you got to bite on this and accept that you cannot possibly do 100% here and 100% here in terms of your own ambitions, right? And that's hard. So then finally, social life. Like, my social life sucks. It's like it exists, but that's where I've paid the biggest price by far. I trimmed down to like a few friends that truly matters to me. And that's been great. And it works for me. I'm very confident that that's what I want to do. But I can see other people living very meaningful lives with a very different setup.
Yeah, but I mean, at the level, you know, that you sit and what you work with on a daily basis, you have 24/7, like all of us. And, you know, what I've learned over the years that life, again, this is a little black and white, maybe oversimplistic, but life is sort of four buckets. You have your health, you have your family, you have your social, and you have your professional. Hmm. And for most people who have very, very complicated lives, such as yourself as an example, usually we can choose three of those four buckets, and we need to be able to prioritize. Of course, you know, if you're a good father and a good husband, you're going to, one of those buckets is going to be your family, because by giving to your family, in a sense that you feel a sense of contribution, you feel a togetherness. And then obviously you need to take care of your health physically and mentally in order to be there for the family, for the business. And the third bucket in your case is the professional life. Yeah. And so sometimes, and that's what I mean by we need to have integrations. We need to be good with trade-offs. You know, working with so many different professionals over so long, I've seen this play out time and time again. It's almost like these hard-learned traditional ways of thinking. These are core things that sometimes we need to be able to do. And as you said, your business, it's also your brainchild, right? It's almost like your third child per se, right? And maybe, you know what I'm saying? Because you want to dedicate time. You want to see it, Zanetta, grow and prosper and develop and become something healthy, something that adds to the social fabric of this community, right? So I can see that. So I just really like to do that. But as you said, it's been, you know, my question is, what kind of mental gymnastics or acrobatics did you have to make to accept that maybe my social life I have to dampen down the temperature there, and I have to focus on these other three spheres that we've been talking about? I mean, you said that was difficult and a challenge for you to accept. Can I ask you more nuts and bolts? What do you say to yourself?
It's about picking what you think is most important for you personally, deep inside. Seriously, ultimately, I wouldn't do this if I constantly sort of yearn for something else, right? And that's what I knew, that to me, this opportunity is so exciting, so fulfilling, so educational, that I want to go on this journey. And I want to try it out. And that comes with the price of X, Y, and Z. Now, in order to minimize X, Y, and Z, I'm going to pick some of it, right? So I don't feel necessarily alone entirely, right? And then I think I also deliberately decided to invest enough time in family and my wife this is how I describe it to her. It's like, that's my platform. And then when I go out and spread my wings and do the stuff that I'm excited about, that's primarily Zanetta. Every once in a while, really, I'll do some social stuff to stay in touch with those few friends that I genuinely deeply care about. Mm-hmm. And then so that's purely a prioritization thing in terms of what fuels you the most.
And I think also another point I just like to address is that, you know, the successful entrepreneurs that I've talked to, men and women, a lot of the times their success comes back down to having the support at home, their wife or their husband. You know, it's not always an easy road, but they are there. They have their six, they have their back. They feel that support. That so when they have to make that trade-off where tell their significant other, you know, this Thursday, I have to be 110% dedicated to the job, but that they are able to share their expectations and clarify their expectations. And their wife or husband says, you do what you got to do. I'll take care of the kids or the dog or the cat or whatever it is, the house. But then there's this sort of give and take, right? And so if you have this sweet balance, if you have this integration at home where you can play on each other and support each other, I found that a lot of that is the fuel that can create that equanimity for people to deal with complex lives. So I just want to say kudos to your wife, even though I don't know her.
Yeah, listen, but it hasn't been easy. She's a very ambitious person as well, and the sacrifices she has needed to make hasn't come lightly for neither her nor me, right? And the added response, you collectively decide to get kids, right? Mm. And my father ran a business as well, and he worked, you know, back when it was no opportunity to work remotely, right? So he was just gone, right? And I never wanted that for me, my kids, nor my wife, right? So personally, putting that pressure on somebody else who have their own aspirations, who's doing great in their profession, to take the additional burden of controlling more at home because I'm traveling. Like January, Zurich, Marbella, Hamburg. Paris. And then comes February, right? And it's month after month after month, year after year. And that amount of additional strain on one individual in that relationship where it's supposed to be a common decision to get those kids is pretty hard. So it's been some deep conversations as to, do we really want this as a family, right? But then on the other side, it's been this phenomenal experiences. When we opened up the New York office in 2016, we took both kids and me and went for 3 months to live in Manhattan, right? Mm-hmm. So we've gotten so many of these experiences that most people don't get, right? Also together. So, yeah, but it's still something that, you know, I think going from 30 to 40 has been a massive eye-opener for me in so many ways as to how short and how long life is, right? Because when I was in early 30s, I felt everything needs to be done now immediately and with such a rush. Then when I got to like 35, 40, I think both my wife and me became way more patient, realizing that if you want, you can work to maybe probably 70 years old. So making some calls now, pausing something maybe for her now for a while to free up more flexibility between us and as a family is something we finally pulled the trigger on. And she started part-time studying after last summer. And that's a decision we should have done when we were 30, when we got our first kid. But all we could think about is like, holy shit, we're in a rush. And she got a high-level position within her business, managing 70 people or so. So it's like we were both working our socks off while getting kids, but we had no perspective. And back then I had a coach. She was 75 years old. She was phenomenal. I kept her for like 4 years. And she gave me this sort of perspective that you have no idea when you're 30 years old. You think everything is it needs to be done immediately. But once you get into 60, you look back and it's like, what are these young ones stressing about? So it's taken me, I would say, 5 to 10 years to get more perspective as to like, we don't need to do everything in one go. We can focus now. Maybe I'll do this for a few years. Then you can go and do something else and so forth. So yeah.
Well, that's the beauty of experience because it shapes us. It's constantly molding us. Like, as you said, if you go into Marbella or Paris, the man who jumps on that plane and then comes back at the end of January, he's going to be a different man shaped by his experience. But what I also hear is that, you know, when you're in your 30s, you're just a completely different headspace. And by the time you're 40, another decade under your belt, you have more wisdom gained. And so it's not to detract from the man or the woman, your wife, back in your 30s, because you were driven by different sets of values, but those values have maybe matured or they have evolved based on your experiences. And so the man who's 40 now will not be the same man in a decade when he's 50. He'll look back with even more wisdom, with more insight, with more learnings.
Yeah, that's what I realized. It's always backwards, right? Isn't it? So you never get smart enough to understand sort of how it's going to look forward. Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if, you know, if when we have sort of more technology with DNA and we extend our lives to 150, maybe 200 years at some point. But imagine how much wisdom a human being would have picked up over 200 years than the sort of normal 80, 85 years in the West, right? Yeah. But anyways, that's a whole different podcast. I'm just very respectful of your son, Patrick. I was wondering, you've shared a lot of advice, a lot of the sort of the learnings you've picked up along the way to shift your mental game. What advice would you give to any aspiring entrepreneurs out there or leaders, just leaders themselves?
Yeah, there's so many things. What I actually think is, if I were to say anything, I would say, don't even consider being a leader if you don't genuinely care about people. It's going to be about them and not about you. Sometimes it feels like you're a trash can. I have in my one-on-ones, a substantial amount of time is sitting and sort of taking in everything that is problematic for the other person, right? So you become almost like an adult in the room, and you need to contain all of that emotionally, which means that if you genuinely don't care about them and you as people and human beings, it's going to be hard for you to sit there and take all of that in. And I believe once we part ways, once we sort of go out of those one-on-ones, they've had a chance to empty all the shit. We've talked about everything they need to do. And my job is then to motivate them and inspire them to go and execute as good as they possibly can on that. That means that there is very little time for me to tell my sort of burdens and complaints. And that's what I mean about caring about people. So that would be one of my biggest points in order to try and avoid some of the traditional gibberish that goes around. But I would really challenge everyone. You can obviously build a company and then find somebody else to run it. Go for it, right? But if your intention is to go build it and lead it and run it, then you should carefully consider your appetite to deal with people's challenges professionally and personally, because that is holy shit, whether it's their mom died of cancer or whatever it is, it's going to come so many of those things. And you gotta carry the relationship emotionally and inspire them professionally.
And then, it sounds like you have to develop your psychosocial emotional intelligence and be able to apply that to communicate and to be there for people, to actually listen to them so they feel valued and heard.
And when you do that over and over and over again, you should think about whether that is something you enjoy and really aspire to do. Otherwise, you should find somebody else to do it. So it doesn't mean don't build a company, go for it, but really think about who's the ideal one to lead it as it grows and get people on board. Then, we could talk about being harsh on and strict on the sort of vision and sticking to it, but being flexible enough to adjust it when you really realize it doesn't work. There's so many things that we already touched upon, and the grit and resilience and finding the things that motivates you, gives you energy. There's so many of these things, but I would assume most of them will be found for those who go looking. But thinking about that people component, because you won't be able to build it alone, right?
Well, that's very, very good advice. What we've talked about is being very pragmatic. And I appreciate your vulnerability and talking about the tough road that you and your business partner had to climb, but your ability to integrate with your life. And, as you said, you communicate your wife, you support each other, but it's not always been an easy road. But all these different elements have add to the dynamics of this conversation. And I think there's so much to pull from this, because there are time-tested values here that we speak of that any of us can employ and apply to our lives. And so I think you're a living example, not to compliment you, but as an observation, you're a living example of a lot of the philosophies we've talked about today and a lot of the touch points a lot of us could adopt into our lives and weave it into our lives.
It's been an absolute pleasure, man. Thank you for having me on.
You're more than welcome. As we wrap up today's brilliant conversation with Patrick Berglund, we've transversed the landscape of entrepreneurship from the challenges and the learning curves to the personal strategies that sustain growth and balance. Patrick credits much of his personal management to having an external coach who created a space for reflection and fresh perspective on challenges. In our conversation today, he also emphasized the importance of setting boundaries between work and life, leveraging a dumb phone to disconnect, and living by the mantra, a little bit less, which forces him to prioritize. Patrick also candidly shared that not all tasks will be completed, comparing his to-do list to a leaking ship that requires prioritizing the largest leaks first. This journey has taught him to be more conscious and critical about where he invests his energy and his time, a lesson that's invaluable for any entrepreneur. And Patrick, a personal thank you from me to you for sharing your time and insights with us today. Your journey and the wisdom you've imparted will offer invaluable lessons not only for entrepreneurs, but for anyone seeking to navigate challenges with resilience and foresight. Your approach to learning, prioritization, and self-management serves as a recipe that any of us can adopt. So Patrick, I'm deeply grateful for the depth of our conversation today and the perspective you've shared. So thank you. Well, folks, if any of you are interested in contacting Patrick or exploring Zenetta, I will leave all the links and contact information in the show notes. And as we cross the finishing line of yet another episode, if I may ask you for a call to action, if you enjoy the content of the show, this episode, the podcast, could you kindly share it with colleagues, relatives, family, friends? You'd be doing me a huge solid on that front. Because it's sometimes hard to get the word out there since there's so many podcasts, so many brilliant podcasts. And I'd like to think my content has helped you in some way, giving you some insights, knowledge, some skills. So for example, if you have a profile on LinkedIn, maybe you could take a couple of minutes just to create a short post suggesting people listen, subscribe, and rate my podcast. You'd be doing me a great favor. Well, folks, thank you for your time and thank you for your listenership. Until the next time we meet, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.